I'm introducing Danny Dorling. Danny is Professor of Human Geography at the University of Oxford, but has worked at a variety of other universities in Sheffield, Newcastle, Bristol, Leeds, and also in New Zealand. He went to university in Newcastle upon Tyne and was brought up in Oxford. And he's published a range of work covering many broad areas. He's published over 40 books and produced many atlases as a social geographer, as a human geographer. But today he's going to concentrate on issues to do with student funding, which, as all of you know, is a subject very dear to my heart. So I leave you to it.
Thank you ever so much for the invitation. I'll try and stay out of the way of this so you can see the slides. The reason I wanted to come and talk here, and I'm very grateful to get the chance, is that I think we need a national conversation about what to do about the debt. Because if we don't have a conversation about what to do about the debt, things could go wrong, policies could be enacted in haste, which cause problems, or, to give you a kind of extreme scenario, given that we know that the main opposition party is committed in its manifesto for no more fees and loans from the day after they come to power, given that the third largest party in Parliament, the Scottish National Party, are very happy with that as well, this is a possibility. Now imagine that you're a young person, you're 16 or 17, and you're becoming interested in politics and interested in university, and it suddenly dawns on you that if you were to go to university the year before a Labour government or Labour coalition come to power, you could be signing up to a loan that could be £50,000, £60,000, £70,000, £80,000. But if you're just to wait for a year, go around the world, say, do whatever you want, you could make yourself a fortune in terms of what you wouldn't lose by going to university a year later. Now, the young people of Britain haven't yet worked this one out, or they don't think that the chance of that government yet is high enough. They haven't factored it in, or their parents haven't factored it in. In many cases, it's the parents, I think, that choose whether you go to university or not, not you, particularly the mother, who chooses which university you go to. But as we begin to see this coming government disintegrate in the most spectacular way, as we go through Brexit, that possibility becomes more and more likely. We are living in very strange times. The third party, this is the first time since 1918 that the third party has been the Nationalist Party. The last time was Sinn Féin in 1918. Very big things happen when this kind of thing goes on. I'm calling it Jubilee 2022, but what I'm going to propose, what we'll get to, isn't quite a Jubilee. A Jubilee is when you cancel all debts. I'm not suggesting the cancellation of all debts. I'm suggesting something that would, I think, be fairer. And the argument about this is all going to be about fairness. The argument about loans was all about fairness. It wasn't fair for working class white van man to be paying through his, always his, taxes for the middle class to do media studies. That was the kind of argument that was given. This is the abstract, so I am going to concentrate on what I said I was going to do. The current system in England, I'm only going to talk about England, we can worry about Northern Ireland and Wales later if you want. I think it is patently unfair. It is unfair because the best off students go to university for free. That is the most important thing to know. There are only fees and loans for the bottom 92% who go to university or less. The best off go for free. They pay nothing and they have no loan. The proportion who go for free varies by university. It's much higher in my University of Oxford than it is in other universities. Because if you've been paying for your children to go to school, say at the extreme is £35,000 a year plus £15,000 for the school trips, £50,000 a year, £250,000 from age 13 to 18. If you've been paying that, the idea that you're going to tell little Dave that Dave suddenly has to take out a loan, it doesn't happen. Inefficient. The argument for student fees and loans relies on future inequality. The argument is that graduates are going to earn so much money in future that this is only fair and it makes sense to do it. It actually locks in or tries to lock in future inequality into the economy. We are, as I'll show you later, the most economically unequal country of Europe already. It's kind of Osborne's win the global race, can we become even more? You know, it's not good enough already to be this unequal. We need to be even more unequal. Inequality is dramatically inefficient. More equal countries are more efficient in so many ways. And anyway, it's unsustainable. It's a kind of accounting trick where we can put things off the books and then a future generation can worry about it. It also makes universities behave in very terrible ways. It makes you as a university begin to spend more and more and more money on marketing. That's what you do. Because at the margin, you have to get the students in. You also don't want to spend that much on teaching them, because that would lose you money that you need to spend on the marketing to get them in. It's an open market that you've created. I can go on and on about this, and we can have an argument about the system, but essentially I think that argument has largely been won. That's why it's in the Labour Party manifesto. You still hear people arguing for fees and loans, partly because they were part of the group that introduced them, and accepting that a large amount of your life's work was a huge error is a really difficult thing to do. That's HEPI, if any of you know what HEPI is. But also, you know, the nicer think tank, Wonky, are funded by universities who pay subscriptions that they can only pay because they're getting this bonanza of income in. So we have a very skewed debate where the vested interests of people are there. They're going to go, accept that, and let's see what you have to work out next. Now, Jeremy Corbyn got criticised because he didn't have an answer to what you do about the existing loans. And a whole lot of lies were said about what he actually said, because people like misquoting Jeremy Corbyn, because they hate Jeremy Corbyn. They hate Jeremy Corbyn, in my view, because he's so unremarkable. The really, really interesting thing about Jeremy Corbyn is how, I'm gonna put it really bluntly, really, how crap he is. And that's the frightening thing. The frightening thing is that you can have a Labour Party led by somebody who's not Machiavellian, who hasn't secretly plotted to do this, who is not brilliant at stage managing his apparatchiks and buttering people up. And still he keeps winning the argument, and the political party grows to 500,000. If he was like Tony Blair, if he wore cufflinks, if he dressed up smartly in a suit and so on, then you could have a plausible kind of argument about why he's beating you. The scary thing for people who like inequality in fees and loans is that a man of so little ability, in a way, and a party which is not run by people who are super able are managing to do this. I'm not worried about the fees and loans before 2012, the ones that went up £1,000 fees, then £3,000 fees. That's in the past. Part of it is being sorted out by repayments, and things get really, really tricky if you begin to think about repaying people their actual payments. So I'm not going to look at before 2012. I am very angry that we think it is okay to groom a 17-year-old child to take out a loan when it would be illegal to sell them a car on hire purchase or a washing machine. I cannot believe that the cases that have gone to court haven't gone further through. Of course, nobody is allowed to sign their student loan agreement till the day they're 18, but the grooming happens for years before that. And it really is grooming. I mean, it is a, you know, kind of terrible buttering up of this is the best decision you'll ever make in your life. And you're going to get so many angry stories in future from this. At the moment, young people, when it goes wrong, they go to university for a year, they drop out, they're left alone, they all blame themselves. And that helps us get these astronomical levels of mental health up. You know, it's kind of win the global race for how bad can we make our young people feel. But But that individualised anger, that internal anger that generations have felt, will at some point turn, and people will realise it was not their fault that they believed what the adults told them at 15 and 16 and 17. And that politically is really interesting. We've now got 10 years worth of generations that have been treated in this way, and we've got their parents and some of their grandparents that will be angry about it. So how did we get here? Why did we get to this? This is the basic income inequality graph of the UK. Around about 1910, 1920, we were very unequal. This is the share of the top 10%. These are the very rich. We become more and more equal through to the 1970s, and then inequality rises. And for me, this distribution underlies many, many aspects of English society, what's happened. During the time when we were becoming more equal, we increased access to universities. We passed laws in the Houses of Parliament that said that Oxford and Cambridge had to take scholars as well as gentlemen, that you could no longer have the direct line from Eton to certain colleges. We became more generous in terms of the maintenance that we were willing to give and the numbers that were able to get them. By this year here, 1962, my mother and father went to university. And my dad had his grant cut off from his father because my dad's father was very well off. He was a private surgeon. My dad had the stupidity to tell his father that he wanted to work in the NHS. His father believed that this was a truly evil thing to do because state healthcare is a terrible evil from his point of view. And so he cut all the money off to my dad for his 7-year medical degree. But my mum's grant from West Yorkshire was enough for two of them to actually live on, as long as they didn't eat meat. And so he got a medical degree, and there wasn't a fee, the fee was waived. He got a medical degree on the basis of one grant. No debt at the end of it. And then spent his entire life working in the NHS. This kind of thing was normal. This kind of thing is normal in almost all the rest of Europe. This kind of thing is something that young people today don't know happened. In the late 1970s, the country began to become more unequal. It was a battle won by conservatives who wanted greater inequality. They think inequality is good. It's rewarding tall poppies. That's what Margaret Thatcher said. And as the inequality in income and the gap between people rose, you slowly see a changing attitude about what universities are for and what they're about. Till you get to the point where Labour Party introduces a £1,000 fee and then a £3,000 fee, and then there's a Brown review, a stitched up review by a man who used to work for BP and 8 others, including one student, to recommend that we go for a free market in this. Peter Mandelson makes a deal with Dave Willetts around about 2010. Labour, New Labour, and the Conservatives are as one about going to £9,000. The Liberals make a play about not going for it, but they didn't believe in it that much. We know they didn't believe about it that much because they actually implemented it after 2010. And then we go on and on. Other European countries aren't like this. It's the underlying inequality. And the underlying inequality affected the thinking of people like Peter Mandelson. It made Peter what he was. It affected the education that David Willetts got. Right? It's not David Willetts' fault that he made these terrible mistakes. He was brought up at a time when increasingly he was taught that individualising everything and going for the market was a good idea. Had David been moved to another European country, odds are David would have had very different views. My last slide on this. On the day of Margaret Thatcher's funeral, all these pictures, by the way, come from a book called Peak Inequality, so I'm just taking the graphics out of that. It comes out in July. On the day of Margaret Thatcher's funeral, a professor at the University of Manchester put this little note and a bunch of flowers on Harold Wilson's grave. And the note reads, "On the day of the pompous and prodigal funeral of a greatly overrated Prime Minister, this is a simple and respectful tribute to a greatly underrated Prime Minister who sowed the seeds for the quality, fairness, compassion in our country, and his crucial contributions are not acknowledged even by his own party. It's a Greek professor at the University of Manchester who stuck that note. Oh, Harold Wilson was instrumental in the Open University, probably the biggest, fastest rise of access to university for people. I partly put that note up because by chance I sat at dinner the day after Margaret Thatcher's funeral with David Willetts. It wasn't an easy time. He insisted on me coming up with one good thing Margaret Thatcher had done, and he was very emotional that day afterwards, and I could. Margaret Thatcher, when she was Education Secretary, deemed that every child is educationable in Britain because Baroness Warnock told her to, and she did it. But that's the only thing. If you want a challenge, try and think of something else Margaret Thatcher did, which was a good thing.
Now, we go to one more. Introduce more comprehensive schools than anybody else.
What's that?
Introduce more comprehensive schools.
Oh, she did, but she didn't want to.
Oh, no, she didn't want to, but she did.
Yes. Yeah, thankfully, otherwise I wouldn't have gone to one. I'm very grateful to Margaret Thatcher. I was educated. I'm not going to go on and on, don't worry. I'm going to finish. I was very lucky to be educated in the late 1970s in Oxford, just as the schools had become comprehensive. And the amazing thing about this was that the secondary modern was in the north of the city, and it was called Charwell. And for those of you who don't know, secondary moderns are special schools that the English had for people who you're not going to let have any future, where 80% went. The secondary modern was in the north of the city. The grammar was near to the county car plant. It was a county school, what became Pierce School. And that's the school that all the middle class wanted their children to go to. You suddenly make all these schools comprehensive, and nobody knew where they're supposed to send their child. Because if you live in North Oxford, should you send them to what had been the secondary modern, or should you still send them down to the what had been the grammar school? As a result, in the late 1970s, children just went to the nearest school in my city. The 80s weren't bad either. It was only the publication of school league tables which then helped to produce a huge divide between these schools. A house price divide of £100,000 between each of the six catchments in Oxford, and resulted in Charwell, that secondary modern, becoming the Charwell, and now being the Tatler magazine recommended comprehensive to go to. Anyway, you've had enough time to look at that graph as you get bored by me speaking. This is the graph of the extent of possibilities. It's statistics from the IMF, on the proportion of GDP that's spent on public services in these countries since 2002 through to the projections for 2020. The big rise in the middle is the bailing out of banks. And the really big rise is Ireland following George Osborne's advice. And they should ask for some money back for that. We are down here at 36% of GDP that we spend on public services and debt repayment and arms and so on. The USA is on a par with us, and Ireland is in terrible trouble. 36, 35, 32. You probably know that the schools in Finland are okay. Probably sick of hearing about the schools in Finland are okay. I'm sure the Finns are. 57% spent on public spending. And when there's an economic crash, what the Finns do is you increase the proportion of GDP you spend on the public services so you don't have to cut them. Rocket science, right? But the Finns are very clever people. We know this because we measure through PISA the ability of children across Europe. And we know that the children in these countries are far better at maths and things than the children in these countries. But it's not just Finland, this is France on 54, Sweden, Italy, Greece, Germany on 43, we're at 36. Does anybody want to guess what the costed implications of a Labour government would have been? 2017 manifesto? What would it have raised the 36 to if Corbyn had come to power and done what he promised? Any guesses?
45.
Not 45?
38.
Yeah, very close, between 37 and 38. So this is the window that we're moving in. the widest gap between our political parties for generations, I think since the 1930s. And we're playing a game, and it's a realistic game because you just can't jump to Germany. We're playing a game of, do we want to be here, or do we want to be here, or do we want hard Brexit Empire 2.0 to be down here? So you're going to have lots of choices. These countries don't have student loans and fees, because you pay for it in the obvious, sensible way you would do if you'd had a good education and you knew how to do maths. And you hadn't been indoctrinated by a certain kind of philosophy from the United States, by a man called Friedman that said everything must be made marketable and you must have vouchers for it all. And then the quality will be ever so high. There were lots of other things going on. This graph shows the proportion of people who own their house or have a mortgage. Time along the top from 1983 to about 2012, age from 18 down to 89, and that's the lucky generation who got to get a mortgage and who are paying the lease for their housing over the course of their lifetimes. So me, I am here, just in it. Only just. I almost failed to buy a house in Oxford, and I'm a statutory professor at the university. Older than me, fine. We forget about this lot. Private renting was the norm in Britain in the past, which is why we regulated it and got rid of most of it, because it was terrible. And this is the new private renters. There are lots and lots of other things going on. There's a context to all of this. This comes from the now defunct Social Mobility and Child Poverty Commission. You know, you really know things are going badly wrong when an entire commission resigns, including, I forget the name of the deputy, Gillian. You know, these were hardly radicals to be in this commission. The government had, a few years earlier, insisted that the word poverty be taken out, so it was only social mobility. But even then they all resigned. The graph is the proportion of families with children in the whole of England who have to rent privately. And you can just see the disaster 2006-07 onwards. It's now over a quarter. Renting privately is not good if you've got children, because your landlord can evict you with 2 months' notice and you don't stay at the same school. This is an experiment in how quickly can we destroy the achievements of London schools, I think. You know, how much can you move children between schools in London and see that incredible improvement that London saw, partly due to immigration, but London challenged a bit, school teachers a bit. You introduced this thing this fast. This wasn't planned. The increase in private renting wasn't supposed to be for families with children, but we're out of control at the moment. And part of the reason why we get £9,000 a year fees is that we're out of control. You only behave this ridiculously when you actually have lost the plot. I know I should talk in more academic language, but I'm trying to be honest with you about where I think we are. There are winners. There have to be winners. You can't do this kind of thing when nobody wins. Obviously, the families who could afford to pay their children's fees up front are winners. The money is peanuts to them. School fees are higher. In fact, you know, it's kind of like you can go on a few more holidays once the kid goes to university. And you live in a country where you pay the lowest tax in Europe as a rich person, because you're banking on all the people below you taking out these loans. But there are also winning universities. These red universities, this is Oxford. Here we are in UCL. We're complicit, we're a winner here. Cambridge. In the LSE as well. Queen Mary's interesting, it just about got in, and Bristol. The ratio to work out the winning is actually research money per student. It's never done as a ratio, but it kind of shows the institutions that most benefit from the current way of doing things. And that's part of the reason we've got to the point. If do something that really annoys Oxford and Cambridge is much harder. Do something that Oxford and Cambridge are happy about and you can do it. And there were other winners. The University of Reading. Reading now books out every single hotel in the city, so that when the students come in September, they can put them in a bed and try and hold on for them for as long as they can. Students leave rapidly and they fill them up in their halls of residence. Brand new, shiny halls of residence in Reading, Bristol, Exeter. It's all down here. It turns out we didn't used to have a market. We used to have Stalinist quotas in terms of how many students each university could take. And if you go 0.5% above or below your quota, you're fined. And I went to Newcastle from Oxford. And I thought that all the other southerners who were going up to Newcastle and Leeds and Manchester really wanted to be there, because they said they really wanted to be there. And they wanted the experience of living in the north. There were upsides to introducing a free market. We've discovered that they were lying. Or at least their parents were lying. In particular, their mothers were lying. You look after a child until 18, and turns out parents are nicer than I thought, and they don't just want to get rid of them. They want them to be within 2 hours of where they are. The vast bulk of area that produces Russell Group students, I'm sorry for my bias about Russell Groups, but I found I've only ever worked in them and I'm stuck. That's where they come from, and West London. So what opening up the market does in choice actually heats up particular places that are not being chosen for their, you know, supreme diversity of teaching, whatever, or for the fact it really makes a lot of sense to have a lot of students in Sheffield and Newcastle and Liverpool, because there are a lot of housing and your staff can live a nice life and you can go and walk in a hill, that kind of thing that you can't do in the south. But that was one of the outcomes. This is where I think we are now. We're in 1913. This picture was taken in 1913 at the annual Harrow-Eton cricket match. For those of you, I am now completely in this culture. I can spot a Harrovian boy, that kind of hat and a cane. Winston Churchill always had his cane just so that you knew he went to Harrow. So those are the Harrovian boys. They're their fathers, wearing the hat, because dad went to Harrow, and there's the mums with bits of bird, large amounts of bird in their hair. 1913 was the peak of economic inequality in Britain. Maximum number of servants that we'd ever had. Really, really, really unequal. We're back at the peak of inequality, not as high as 1913, but we're in a particularly weird time, which is thought of as completely normal. They thought this was completely normal. Within a few months, so it's 1914, this picture, within a few months of this picture, war broke out. A war that was supposed to just last the summer. And then everything begins to change. You get a revolution in Russia and so on. So let's zoom forward to 1936, 37. Same cricket match. Most famous picture in social science, on the cover of at least 6 books. And the point of the picture, the reason the picture is shown so often, is that the two boys in the hats are looking nervous. Something's changed. And the three boys who are being paid, they got pennies for taking cushions to the crowd so that your bum didn't get numb, are looking cocky. And I can go on and on about this picture. I think a whole book's actually been written about this picture. It's a very sad story. One of those boys died of rheumatic fever within 6 months, the posh boys. And the other posh boy died in a mental institution after several decades of severe illness, following the picture being taken. The three working class boys, as far as we know, are still alive. He did the best. He was the tallest. And he lived in a house where they only had between 2 and 3 people sharing a room. The short one, looking a bit angrier, was in the most overcrowded house. Still done okay. Anyway, we won't. That's where I want us to get to. Right? I'm not talking about utopia. It's trying to go from the peak of inequality that we are now to something like that. That's achievable. If you're the most unequal country in Europe, you don't go, let's be Norway. It's not. Believe me, it's not. the kind of amount of... do you do those kind of sessions where you sit around and work out your implicit biases and things? Yeah? We'd have to do years of that to become Norway. We're just not going to do it in a generation. Right? I think we need to aim to be averagely unequal. The kind of campaigning that's effective or may be effective is this kind of thing. This is the Occupy protest about the debt in the US. Not yet effective, but it's a great rallying cry to young people to tell them something's wrong with their society. I've never checked the sizes of the circles. It's really effective campaigning because nobody ever bothers to check the size of the circles. You just look and go, that's terrible. If you actually look at it, you go, can't actually be growing that fast, can it? The US is the worst example on the planet for how to deal with students. It had its own Trump University, just a gift for writing about it. It has a whole series of universities which still spend more on marketing than they do on teaching. Produces students, so in some cases, who really know absolutely nothing, but are convinced because of their GPA scores that they're mini geniuses. And turn up in Europe and get a shock because they haven't been taught despite the amount of money that they paid and borrowed. The US is worse, Chile's also in a terrible state. Chile is the only OECD country that spends more than us on private schools, by the way. In case you didn't know, the mainland doesn't really have private schools. But Japan's the interesting exception. Not everything fits along the line, but essentially most countries don't do this. I thought I should put up one academic-y graph just to say I do these kind of things. The kind of thing I'm interested in, this is looking at the children born in Bristol in the 1990s, where we have their entire genome and the placentas. And if you really want to study children, having the genes as well is absolutely fascinating. And this is looking at the achieved A levels of those who went to state and private schools in Bristol by a measure of their ability done, I think, at about 11. And the key point is that the ones who were not very able but went to the private schools get high A levels. I always think Prince Harry and his GCSEs. His A levels are more true, but essentially the private schools will get high A levels out of a child not destined for high A levels. The best quarter from the state schools are essentially below the third quarter for the private schools. We're looking more and more at this. And we're looking at what evidence there might be for inherent differences in children. Because at the heart of the argument for inequality is that some people are inherently, genetically, or God-given. Michael Gove gives to church as well as listen to Dominic Cummings. Different. That's the heart of the inequality. Some children are different. They are much, much cleverer. They have a potential. This is the key word. They have a potential to be much, much more able. And other children, the bulk of children, unfortunately, and it's not their fault, have genes that mean they will never amount to much. And what an education system should do is find the clever children, the inherently clever children, and spend more money on them because they've got such higher potential. And hence you can justify $35,000 a year because it's money well spent. And you really need to keep cutting that state budget in those primary schools and so on, because you're just wasting cash on the genetically unable. It's part of the argument. And you need the Social Mobility Commission, because you've got to spot the few children with the strange genes from the lower orders who might go on and become Michael Gove. And that is the thinking, to put it crudely. So the fascinating thing at the moment, since 2010 we've had genome-wide analysis, you can actually begin to look at this, and you find it isn't true. And you also have wonderful papers coming out. There's one with 10 authors that came out about a month ago. And one of the authors is Toby Young. He's an author of that paper. Paper claiming that children who go to private schools and grammar schools have superior genes. Now these papers are an absolute gift because you can then go and test them to see, is it true? There's also logical reasons to think why it wouldn't be true. The basic entry criteria for a private school is cash. For a grammar school, there is a test done at 11, but for a private school, it's cash. So is it that all the clever people have become rich and they can pass on their riches to their children? What you begin to find is that the genes that they associate with cleverness are beginning to look like the genes you might associate with being greedy. And that makes a lot more sense. Because for millennia, human beings have varied on their level of greediness. Some people are greedy, some are not. There are evolutionary reasons to think it makes sense to have a variation in greediness. The one I'll give you is all the genetics for being fat have now been done. I always feel good doing this because I don't think I'm prejudicing anybody because I've deliberately eaten more so I can do this part of the talk. Until 1990, we had an environment which was not obesogenic. It was quite hard to get fat. Since 1990, we've flooded it with food to test out who's got the fat gene and who hasn't. And it turns out, those of you in this room who are thinner may think it's your self-control and your sport and the rest of it, but it's probably your high metabolism. And those like me who are larger, okay, I'm a bit lazy and I snack a bit, but actually, or to quote my friend George David Smith, who I work on this, short of locking me up in a prison cell and just sliding lettuce under the door, Danny, you're going to be fat. And that's the results from the fat gene. Why do we have variations in propensity to be fat? Because it makes sense to have human populations which have some fat people in them. Because one day there's a famine. And I'm afraid you skinny lot are going to go first. I'll still be around. But in general, you skinny lot are going to live longer because I'm going to get heart disease earlier. So it makes sense to have a variation. The fun thing about genes, all genetic disadvantages disappear unless there's an advantage. So we all have an opposable thumb, unless anybody wants to tell me I don't, because this thing is useful. We all have binocular vision, because it's useful. To have a genetic variation, there has to be an advantage of not having it. And with fatness, you can see that. Sometimes it's worth being fatter than other times. And with greediness, you might need some greedy people in your society. You can't all be laid-back hippies or be nice to each other. But the majority of people are pro-social and are laid-back hippies. Anyway, I won't go on and on further. I think this is the most fascinating thing. Social scientists working with geneticists beginning to look at the obsession about IQ and genes, which was largely done in education institutes, you know, since Burke onwards. And only now are we actually getting people who actually understand genes looking at it, rather than the group who basically were obsessed by their own IQ and knew what answer they wanted, which are the only people who published on IQ and genes until now. And the results are going to be fascinating. Right, no more graphs, I promise you. You've got to decide what kind of society you want to live in. We currently live in that society with the curved ladder, the most unequal society in Europe. How many people here are from the mainland of Europe, just running, so who am I not telling anything to? Okay, but you chose to come here, which is interesting. Yeah. And you're different because you're migrants who do have special genes on average. Anyway, a normal European country is a bit boring. It looks like that kind of ladder. One problem about it is that if you've got a kind of bit of get up and go about you, you know, you go to London. But London is like this. I don't know the Institute of Education, but I suspect it'll be a bit like this. But look at the age profile. You know, how many 40-year-olds are there in the building? How many 50-year-olds? How many 60-year-olds? What happened? Is it like this program called Logan's Run? Can you remember Logan's Run? Yeah. They all had to, you got killed off at 30. Yeah. It was survival of the fittest. This is the kind of society that we live in. The Barclays Bank Tower, before the crash in 2007, the one in Canary Wharf, they sacked 1 in 10 of the staff every year. The people who did worse than their appraisals. That's a kind of cutthroat environment they thought would make the bank really, really good. We got the crash. So that's the kind of choice you're going between. Here's the OECD League Table of Inequality by income, just by Gini coefficient. I used to spend a lot of my time arguing about these different measures, and we don't have to worry anymore because they've all lined up and everything shows the same because it's become so extreme. The most unequal country in the OECD is Mexico, then Chile, then Turkey, then the United States. Acacia, it's not now, Lithuania and Estonia keep bobbling up. Russia, and then the United Kingdom. So we're like that set of countries. That's what we are. They're not strange. Turkey isn't strange. Turkey is like here. Istanbul and Moscow are the nearest things to London. There aren't any other cities of that size on this continent. And we're more unequal by income than Israel. So if you want to get an idea about where we are, we're like Israel without the cameras and the bullets, but with the same kind of attitudes between people. The bottom, Iceland, Slovak Republic, Slovenia, Denmark, Norway, Czech Republic, Finland, Belgium, Sweden, Austria, Luxembourg, Hungary, Germany, Korea, France, Switzerland, and so on. So that's your league table. At the moment, most of those countries are getting more equal. Most countries in the world are seeing income inequality fall. And we may just be at the peak of income inequality, but I'll answer that if you want to know later. I put a blog piece up on the Wonky website a few months ago saying that students' loans are a confidence trick for 85%. Got 3 replies. I always look at the replies, I just don't comment on them because that starts a trolling thing. Steph says, the game is up but not perhaps just yet. I'm cynical. Can't support recent changes to the grant system. I recall students with divorced wealthy parents who paid their fees. That thing, hating the, you know. If we look at, in Oxford we give £5,000 to the poorest students. We have the most generous bursaries in the country. I draw a dot on the map for each one of those kids. I draw it red. I draw a dot that's black on the map for all the other kids. The red dots are next to the black dots on the same street. Mum and dad have divorced. Not in all cases, by which I mean 6. But essentially, that is how you get a bursary. John says, Danny, you make some good points, but you underestimate the unfairness. Somebody doing a 4-year course in London ends up owing £90,000. But David says, I'm sorry this article seems to have misunderstood the system. I've misunderstood it. The writing off the loans after 30 years and fixed tax contribution to the system make a lot of what you say nonsensical. This is a politer kind of quiz. I normally get nonsense, you idiot. You don't know what's going on. You should distinguish between poor students and poor graduates. Poor graduates will literally pay nothing for university and it's all fine, go away. So that's kind of a span of reactions. Here's one particular ranking of who has the highest fees in the world, with England at the top. The Financial Times like to dispute this and claim it's the USA at the top. It depends who you include as graduates, but essentially England, USA, Japan is the outlier for an equal country but high fees. Korea, Canada, Australia, Ireland, Netherlands, and then tiny or non-existent. With Scotland down there at the bottom, just a great natural experiment. And the complaint about Scotland was you weren't letting poor kids in. Scotland now lets in poor kids, lets in fewer from the EU. This is research Claire has been involved in, and I have read, and I'm putting it up the show, I have read it, and I do read other things. And this is part, there's a huge amount of
material. And Ariane, she's and the Ariane, key author.
Sorry, yeah, thank you. There's enormous amount of research and books written following students around about how terrible this kind of is. It's like an actual experiment. We're doing something for the benefit of the rest of the world. They sit there in Germany reading this stuff, going, maybe it's okay that we don't have any fees. More children go to university in Germany than go here. 330,000 overseas students go to Germany and pay nothing. And will do after Brexit. If you've got a child who's 14 or 15 and you want them to go to university, tell them how much money they'll make learning German. And not just that, they'll actually learn about a different society. Or go to Bristol and party in a lizard lounge. I'm not going to say anything about maintenance, because I think maintenance is much trickier. The idea of paying people to go in effective boarding schools is odd. I would like us to move towards normal Scottish, continental, even US system where you tend to go locally. And paying of maintenance tends to discourage that. So maintenance is a step too far. And finally, as we get there, so what should we do about existing loans? This is what I want to suggest. You use the end dates, you use 2012 and 2022, 10-year period. No child who made the mistake of being born a year later should be penalised for it. So anybody who enters university in Britain the first year, with the first year of £9,000 fees, should have their payback adjusted so they do not pay back what they would have paid back had they been born a year before with 3,000 fees. Because you've just made the mistake of being born a few months wrong. So that's one end of the taper. The other end of the taper is what happens in 2022. Labour government comes in, or with a coalition with the Scots. No fees, no loans, and you make a promise that the last year that came in, the year just before you were elected, you could call it a bribe if you like, but make a promise that they will also pay nothing back, because you've got 2 years to sort the legislation out. Because they've only just gone to university, you pay nothing till the end of your 3 years. So it's zero for the last year to go in, and it's 3,000 for the first year to go in. And you either draw a straight line, or you might draw a curve, because some of them might have actually paid. That's my suggestion. It's as simple as that. I told somebody in the Times Higher Education about this. It's in the Times Higher today. And he put the standard thing of, this will cost a taxpayer tens or whatever billion. Right? These people are all going to be taxpayers. Right. A Labour government gets in, everybody's going to be paying a bit more tax. Right? Regardless. For hospitals, for schools. This is actually tiny. In the budget overall, this kind of thing is tiny. You're talking half of the property ownership of Oxford and Cambridge universities, which is another thing worth looking at, by the way, with a Labour government, over for the many, not the few. There are 7,900 properties owned by Oxford and Cambridge. The Guardian have the complete list of them. I think there are young Guardian reporters knocking on doors all over London at the moment, trying to see if there's anybody behind the door. And we've got a whole long summer to fill to sell newspapers. So you're likely to see that. I honestly think it's worth coming up with suggestions of what a Labour Party should have as a policy on reducing the loan so that nobody loses out. I think it's well worth working out now and early, rather than doing something like a complete write-off and then somebody says, but I came in 2011, it's unfair. I think you need to discuss it now so that those private companies that might be tempted to buy the loan book from the government that keeps on trying to sell it, know the situation they'll be in. Joe Johnson, the amazing, he's married to Amelia Gentleman, who spent 6 months with the Windrush affair. When at the same time as Amelia was exposing this, Joe was trying to put clauses in to democracy proof the sale of the loan, it's called that, meaning that a future government couldn't do anything about them. All a future government has to do, if somebody is fool enough to buy this loan, is simply introduce a windfall tax on people who bought the loans, equal to the amount, and use that tax to pay back the students. It's all a mess. I would keep the student loans company, because there's jobs there up in Glasgow. I think it's Glasgow. It's a bit like paying people to dig holes and fill them in again. But until you sort out your economy, it makes more sense to get people to dig holes and fill them in again in what you're doing. That last image, for those who don't know, and this is about all the kind of problems we've got still left. That man is a well-known paedophile who is stepping out and looking as if he's suicidal on the high street of Oxford as the highest statue in my hometown. And that statue is still there, and academics will argue for the importance of having a statue of one of the most despotic men in the history of Britain on the high street of the town I grew up in, because they want rich people to think that they will be honoured in future no matter how bad they are. That's the kind of world we need to move away from. That statue needs to be moved indoors, not least because some student at some point is going to get a cherry picker and simply pull it down and somebody could get hurt on that. But there are loads and loads of other things to worry about. We have one of the lowest spending on health and social care in Europe. We've reduced our spending on our schools, and we spend lowly because the elites send their children to other schools and sit on the BBC reading the newspapers and pretending their children go to a normal school and they don't. The country's in such an enormous mess that this is actually going to be a very small part of sorting it out. But I do think it needs a policy that makes sense, and universities need to know what's going to happen. At the moment, universities are worrying about Brexit. As far as I can see, none of them are asking, well, if student fees and loans go, how much are you going to give us for next year's first years? Because universities, just as they thought that Brexit was completely impossible, I remember being there at the time, also think that the Labour government is completely impossible and can't possibly happen, or if it does come to power, it'll come to its senses and not get rid of fees and loans. And there is no way that is going to happen. So you do need to plan. You've let me go on and on and on. Please tell me where I've gone wrong and what's a better idea than this. Because we've got a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, maybe not, but you never know, 2 or 3 years until an election, to work out what is the fairest, most sensible policy, partly for the good of universities, so that you don't suddenly have young people not turning up at all, but going knocking on doors and trying to get a government in that will save them from a lifetime of debt. Thank you.
Great, thank you, Danny. That was considerable food for thought for some. Right, any questions? Go for it.
Thanks very much for a very engaging talk.
Tristan, do you want to introduce yourself?
Tristan McCallum, I work here at Institute of Education. I fully agree with free higher education. I think I'm not quite as confident as you are that the argument has been won, or at least what I see as a valid argument has convinced everybody. Even in the educational research community, people committed to education for all and left-leaning, the idea of fees for higher education is absolutely ingrained. So I do think there's a lot of arguing to be done. But I wanted to ask about this idea of going back from a system that... So I'm not going to address the repaying loans one directly. I'm sure other people have things to say on that. But going back to a free higher education system. And I want perhaps just to be a little bit pessimistic, or at least to raise the question about what happens when you go back rather than just staying with that. And just from my experience, I work a lot in Latin America. So Chile, 2011, massive student mobilization, does an incredibly good job about changing popular perceptions, largely instrumental in the change of government. New government comes in with free higher education. Now, lots of reasons why that hasn't really come to pass, part of it because they, problems with public finances and so forth. But what, in the partial free higher education that has been implemented, it's very different from what it might have been before. Partly because what's sort of free is a bit more like a voucher. So people can take this to the university they go to. It's seen in quite a different way, and it's valid for public and private universities alike. And so I suppose what I'd like to ask is, what happens when you go back? And I'm just thinking that people's, popular perceptions of what university is might have changed, the ways universities organise their finances, the way students relate to universities. And I'm wondering, how easy is it to change all of that?
Thank you. It's very good. This is a common problem with politics on the left in Britain. It's the most depressing thing. So there's a campaign to bring back council housing to the 70s. Make all the schools comprehensive again, like the 70s. Everything is about going back to the 70s. There isn't what the left had in the 20s and 30s, which was plans for things that had never happened before, like comprehensive schools and so on. And what we're lacking is plans for what's new. So in terms of schools, I'd like to see, in my town, there's six comprehensives. I'd like to see them governed by a single governing body, rather than six senior management teams, and a new name for that. So different from what the comprehensives were before. It's asking a lot of politicians who can't even, understandably, come up with what you do about loans, to ask them to envisage what would the new universities be like. They're completely different to what I went to. I went when 6% went to university. You're now essentially talking schools, and it's part of the expansion of the school leaving age. You can draw a line from when the age went from 10 up to 21 and all the battles over it. So something very different. It's much more like FE, much more going locally, so you want to gear things so there's a really big incentive to go locally rather than have this travel around the country. Part of the reason for the travel around the country, which is very English, was to take you away from your family and make you sufficiently robust. This is when these red bricks were first built, because we had to send you to Nigeria next to run it. I mean, we forget there's a legacy of why this country has universities set up as they are, and it comes from the end of empire. But I'd like to see people, you know, people write happy pamphlets on the comprehensive university and so on. I think we should look at what going to university means in other countries in Europe. And it essentially means going to the university of your town, where the lecturers send their own children, which gives you a great respect for the students, and if your children don't go there, then the quality's higher. But it really is universal. So you're teaching people a very wide range of things. My little brother went to learn bricklaying, essentially, at Oxford Brookes, before it became Oxford Brookes, and now will only take you in with two A's and a B, and you buy the name Oxford. Whereas in the past, the Oxford Poly was for local children. But we need a modern idea. It's not that hard to get it, because we're at the bottom of the class. And so we can simply go and look at what happens in other countries and say which of those appears to be the best kind of model, with a tweak or two. But it'll be a different thing. We're currently arranging this incredibly elitist hierarchy, where the idea is that, you know, this will be the same place, you know, the best masters you can get in the world is a masters in education from here. And the problem is the vested interest in that, of which I'm a part. But it's not going to go away suddenly. The other thing that won't change suddenly is the behaviour of parents and pupils. I'm absolutely amazed at how middle class keep on sending every last child desperately to university, and how you could probably put the fees at £18,000 or £27,000 and they'd carry on doing it. So I don't think you'd see a very sudden change in behaviour as you began to change things around a bit. But we need this on all kinds of fronts. We need it for housing. You need a new form of tenure that isn't local authority state controlled housing, because people want a bit more control. And we have a dramatically more educated population now. Half of all women have gone to university. So we should be using the fact that the population is confident and literate to organise things in a different way than we organised them in the past, which was a Stalinist top-down empire organisation, and then a kind of NHS down from the top to a largely illiterate population who, for their own good, needed to be organised. And that was the council house model, that was the comprehensive model. That's why you had an area education officer, a single person in a county who would sort out the schools when they went wrong. And we can't go back to that.
Gabrielle. So, can you introduce yourself?
Oh, hi. Gabriella Melis. I'm a researcher at the Lakes Center here at the IU.
Yeah.
I would like to ask a question about more or less everything that you said, because I think we have really interesting, lots of interesting points. But I think, yes, probably the most important question that I would like to ask you, and possibly all of you here, is why in this country regarding fees for higher education it's really rare, if not probably never heard of it. Why people do not talk about progressive taxation?
Hmm.
Why progressive taxation is never ever mentioned in any party manifesto, in any election, at least for the past, I've been here since 2009. Hmm. I've never seen anything. I went to the student protest again, the increase of the university yes. fees in 2010. I was amongst one of those kettles without even being a student at that time because I was studying English at the time to then go and do my master's in Manchester. While working in restaurants, so why progressive taxation? Why not progressive fee, university fees based on how much your family earns?
Yeah.
As it is in
okay.
for instance, and they find that
really. My shortest answer to this is something happened to our A-level curriculum in the 80s. I did A-level economics, and I was taught things such as rent control creates slums. Things which are completely untrue, but somehow they got into the A-level curriculum. And I was taught that high rates of tax were a disincentive. And I went in the 80s. So you have generations of people who've done economics who've been taught almost a religion. It's almost a religious belief of these things. And so the problem with progressive taxation for them is that you wouldn't get the great British entrepreneurs producing the great British inventions, which comes down to one vacuum cleaner. yes.
No, Dyson. Hoover is much older.
Yeah. And Hoover's American. This is the idea, I think.
But their main factory was in Merthyr Tydfil.
Oh, was it? In Merthyr?
Oh, yes.
And would have employed quite a lot of people, whereas Dyson employed so few people in Malmesbury in Wiltshire that when he moved the manufacturer offshore, it didn't matter anyway. Anyway, this is ingrained that, and so famously Mandelson and Blair said they don't care how much the rich earn as long as they pay their taxes, not progressive taxes, their 45% or 40% tax. The first time you could have seen it, if you look carefully, was the June 2017 manifesto, where John Macdonald for Labour had, if you're in the top, is it 5%? I've forgotten. You might pay a little bit more tax, and was said that he's a Marxist and you can't possibly do it. So, but it's because of these.
Brown's introduction of 10%.
Brown moved the rate by 5. A normal European tax rate is 50% on 50,000 euros. And in a more progressive European country, higher as you go up. The wonderful thing about high taxes is that they're not theft, because they're taken from everybody. And so there's an American economist who's given a brilliant example of, this American economist called Robert Frank wrote the main economics textbook with Ben Bernanke used in the States. And he's done very well. The textbook sold really well. He's got a yacht on the marina. Robert Frank's now in favour of progressive taxation, because as long as everybody on his income is taxed the same, the cost of the berth of the yacht and marina will drop, and he'll still be able to moor his yacht in the marina, and he'll still be able to have a yacht, just the prices of the yachts will fall. So progressive taxation, you lose nothing. It doesn't raise much money. That's the other thing you get. Because it actually stops people being really greedy. So 2007, we had two bankers. They both worked for Lloyds and Barclays. One was getting 4 million a year. The other one had a pay rise to 6 million a year. The one on 4 said, I must get 6. High rates of progressive taxation, in that case, 1995 would be good. Help them not do that. There were all kinds of good reasons for progressive taxation, but we're taught the opposite. My favourite example is Jeremy Clarkson. Jeremy Clarkson would benefit massively from high progressive taxation, heading towards 95% on only over £2 million a year. Jeremy Clarkson's getting old. He's older than me, and he's fatter than me. And he flies to Australia to film a programme with cars for 2 weeks just to get some more money. Now, if you had decent progressive taxation, he could still fly to Australia, but only if you really wanted to. So progressive taxation saves the greedy from themselves. In short, what Britain's failed to do compared to other countries is control the greedy. And there always will be greedy people, and they always need to be controlled. And it's not their fault they're greedy, it's probably their genes, which aren't genes for being clever, they're genes for greediness. And we did the opposite. We celebrated greediness. In the 80s, we did a big bang of our banks, and we said greed was good. And that's why you don't hear it. And it became a mantra, and it became a religion, and it's the core belief of our current political party and government. And it's taught to the elite, if you do A-level economics, if you do PBE, you're taught that greed is good and progressive taxation is terrible and the road to economic ruin.
Thank you. So progressive taxation, thank you for this, but apply to university fees. So students pay as a function of how much
they earn.
Their families earn.
Okay, you could do that, but it's just much simpler to not have fees and just have progressive taxation for everybody.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. And also only a small proportion would end up paying full fees. I mean, 40% of the population pays no tax anyway. If we look at what happened with grants, which were means tested, 60% of the student population got grants.
Yeah.
So the amount of income, even means tested fees would generate would be...
Yeah. But you change this thing from being a business to becoming education.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've almost forgotten what education means in Britain. But and that's our difficulty. So that I become a public servant again rather than a small businessman, which in effect I currently am. And then you can begin to wheedle out of me using the guilt and the other things. An extra 3 hours of work I might not otherwise do. Why should I do more work for my university when all my university is like all your universities is? I'm a mechanism for somebody at the top to get themselves a really high wage and feel good about themselves, and a mechanism to use the hopes and dreams of young people to rip them off. I go to master's course, I go and teach on the master's course in Oxford in the education department, where all the pupils have done their first degree in one of those countries with really high fees, and nobody turns up from a country with no fees, because why on earth would you come and spend, you know, £20,000 on a 1 year course? It can't be that good, can it? And it's a really odd situation to be in. And what I teach on, it's called the economics of higher education, and you're there with a set of students and you're trying to say to them, you could have gone somewhere else and learnt about the economics of education and paid less for it, but you've chosen to come here and pay a fortune. And that's the problem. It's the gap of suddenly realising that you're being ripped off is very big. But it's the only way we can keep going. The only way you can run a university in Britain is to constantly attract postgraduate students paying those fees, and is to charge this, and you know, research income tends to run at a loss. If you look at the cost per square foot of space in this building, you're losing money for every research grant you win. You're only going to make money on your master's students, and that's how you start talking. You start talking on, they're a profitable part of your business. You can't actually give them £20,000 worth of tuition, because then you couldn't do your research, which is what you're well known for. So you have to cost subsidise. But you don't worry about that too much, because they tend to come from very rich families. How else can they pay £20,000? And it's just it's a spiral down of sadness, you know, compared to teaching children rather like your children and actually caring about what you're doing and teaching them and treating them as if they were your family, in the same way as the health service is good when doctors and nurses think of their patients as like them rather than as customers that they can make money out of. I mean, there is a place for the private sector. Clothes is the most obvious, but there's, you know, the private sector is very, very efficient whenever you can be a repeat customer, and you learn how to what's a bad deal and a good deal. And so the more frequently you buy an object like bread, the better the private sector will be. For things that are one-off, like your heart bypass in future or your university education, you know, you don't go back and do another three master's courses just to work out who's fooling you on the first one. One-off purchases do not work in the private sector. They just encourage charlatans.
Vincent.
Hello, I'm Vincent Carpentier from CGLUE. Many thanks. I think you made some great connection between the problems in relation to funding and the transfer from public to private resources in education, higher education, and perhaps with higher education and other sectors like health, housing, and I always thought like the debates on higher education here, but not only here, are really like discussed in isolation from other kind of social sectors, and that the problem of debt, especially for younger generation, is actually more to pay on HE, more to pay on health, more to pay on housing. And I was wondering, what do you think would be the kind of ways to try to join this discussion at some point at the, academic level, can be interdisciplinary, or at the policy level as well, because if they're all discussed in isolation, we can say, okay, they can handle the extra debt in debt, they can handle extra debt in debt, and then if you put all that together, you just like something, as you say, which is totally sustainable. My other question, which is linked to that, is when do we know, or when do we have the evidence? I'm asking that, but I know, that a policy failed. Because debt is about the future always, so you could always say, don't worry, it's going to be fine. Or, using like Keynes in reverse for private debt in some way. Like, in the future.
When has it failed? On the joining it up, I had a 17-year-old work experience student early this week, and I took her to my university's big forum about the pensions. You know, the pensions were a big issue, the strike. And she was sitting there, and she was the youngest person by 30 years, and the room was full of hundreds of academics. And she was listening to the academics talk about, are our pensions safe, what we've already got, and so on. And I didn't realise this, but I just thought this 17-year-old was listening to a set of people wanting to guarantee that they had wealth in their old age. And one way of joining these things up in housing is to point out that somebody of my age, with a mortgage, who went to university free, if I didn't care about other people, I think it's in my interest for this to be sorted out, because by the time I'm 70, this generation will simply just take it back. You know, the idea that they're going to behave themselves and pay the debt, and they're really going to hate me. And in a way, that's already happened one above. So we have life expectancy falling for the non-European born in Britain. It's static, but once you take out the European migrants, it's actually going down. And the people who are dying are people in their 80s, who are dying a few years earlier, who were mostly middle class in 1979 and voted for Margaret Thatcher. And they're now getting what they voted for, which is a dismantled health service. So I would join it up by actually getting people who've benefited. You can think about your children, that's one way. You know, what's there for you? But actually think about your old age. And what happens when this generation, who are paying 9,000 a year, gets big enough, so you've got 20 years of them, what kind of purgatory are they going to put the older generation into? Because the whole country will do worse, so there'll be less money, and at some point I'm going to need a Kafka. How do you judge failure? It's fascinating. In health, you do it by people dying. So for the last 2 years, we've had rising infant mortality in Britain, the only country in Europe with rising infant mortality. The BBC produced a programme saying, oh, don't worry, it's premature births, as if they don't have premature births anywhere else in Europe. But I'm very empirical, so I would actually use cases. In health, it's easier. You only die once, and life expectancy goes up. With education, it's people not finishing their degrees, people being unhappy with their degrees. It's not quite as easy. But I think simply surveying people and saying, was that worth it? So that I've got a couple of lovely surveys from the States. This is really nice. Asking people shortly before death what they regret and what they're happy about their life. And it's fascinating. What they regret in the States is not having made that pass at somebody they quite fancied. You're talking 90-year-olds here. They often regret having been with that person they were with for too long. That's interesting. They regret worrying far too much about things that turned out not to have mattered. That's worth remembering. And the fourth most common one in the States, they regret getting into debt for their education. And if you put that on a par with those other regrets in life, that tells you something's gone badly, you know, because it was a waste of money, what they thought would be useful to them. So those kind of surveys might be a way of doing it. The other measure of failure are these international tests on maths are pretty good, because maths is something, it's relatively easy to compare between countries, whereas, you know, being literate in Finnish is much harder than English, say. And the fact that the UK comes consistently so low on these tells you you've got a failing education system. What we really need, you could do it, you're the right institute for it, do a PISA test on graduates. Right? So actually take an Oxford graduate and give them a basic math test at the age of 21 and so on. PISA did a brilliant test of 21-year-olds, but the population as a whole, and found out that our 21-year-olds are completely useless at maths, because you just learn to get an A at GCSE and you forget about it the next day. Whereas in a normal country, you teach maths to learn maths, which is education. So that would be one way. But this test I suggest you do. Almost all the researchers I've worked with younger than me have come from places like Germany, and they can write computer code and they can do things that are useful. In the last 15 years, I don't think I've hired anybody educated in England to work with me, partly because you've got this incredible pool of incredibly able, well-taught people, whereas the English education system at the elite is you're taught how to be in charge of other people. You're taught to be confident, but you're not actually taught how to write programs in four computer languages and get on and do it yourself. And somebody has to do that.
Right. I studied the...
Do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, yes, sorry. My name is Maria, and I studied the Open University. And I made sure I got into the Open University before the fees increased in 2012. So I'm on ordinary transitional fees, except for my last module, when I have to pay a full fee because I had to take a year out to care for my mother. And there's a big, where the debt has mainly failed is lifelong learning. Mm. Because I'm on my second degree, so I can't take out a student loan. I'd have to finance it myself if I wanted to study further with the Open University. So that's one of the main failures. And it's a big failure. And now the Open University is not going for lifelong learning now. Now they're pushing for young students, because they're the ones who will take
the money,
up the student loans, etc. So I thought I would have.
No, that's good. It's a good case of fact. I mean, the poor Vice Chancellor had to resign a few weeks ago. And I honestly think he was trying. I think that was an impossible job for the Open University to do. And again, think of our old ages. I would quite like, you know, if I stagger on into my 70s and 80s, I'd quite like to learn a language for the first time in my life. I've never learned a language. I'm English, hence uneducated in that way. And the things I would like to do later, and I'd like it to be in a country where I'm not being asked for £10,000 just to go and sit in a room with somebody not being paid that much, talking about can Danny finally learn French or not as a thing to do before I die. And how much is that to ask for? But I'm not going to get that unless we change the way that we do it. But if it's a business and you sell it, then we're entering a very, very different kind of world, where those with lots of money will be fooled into thinking they're being educated. And somebody will say, oh, you speak brilliant French. And it's only when you actually go to France and try and use it that you realise they were simply taking the money from you.
Stephanie Harris, I actually work at University of UK, but I'm on my lunch break, so you can
okay.
Get to me.
Yeah.
I was gonna ask a boring question about in defence of the current system and increased yeah. Labour participation. But I guess most of the arguments we come up with in defence of the current system are because of other policy factors that constrain the current system. So i.e. having more people go to university allows people from widening participation backgrounds go to university, but clearly that doesn't necessarily need to be the case if you have a better lower education system or a more equal education system lower down. So I guess my question really relates to the earlier one, which is there are an awful lot of, it's an interconnected system, there are an awful lot of changes you could make, free education, higher education being one of them, but if you were in power tomorrow, what would you make first, what would you do first?
The main thing I'd do would be to set out the strategy so you can see where you're heading, which lets people know. So Labour, I mean, one thing Labour did do, education. Labour increased participation far faster than Fees did, but that increase was one extra child in a class of 30 in the poorest fifth of the country. And there were shouts of, this is terrible. And one child in 30 from the poorest fifth went. Now you put a price on it and people initially think this is worth something and they go to the university of wherever and they get their degree. And you can, you know, if you suddenly tell 18-year-olds you can all have a car, all you got to do is sign up to this loan and it's yours, you could sell more cars. It wouldn't necessarily be a good thing to do. I would increase the funding for state schools quite rapidly, quite quickly. I would let it be known, I wouldn't ban private schools, which many of my colleagues would, but I would certainly look at VAT. Charitable status is just not excusable. It's just taking the piss. I mean, you know, really, in a way is, the one advantage of charitable status of private schools is it stops them behaving like businesses completely. But I would reduce the incentive of that 7% of society, half of whom really struggle to do it, to take their children out of society, which is what they're doing. I would increase the funding for state schools up to, say, the top of the bottom third in Europe, not that good. I would create these senior management teams for six comprehensives rather than one. So in the case of my city, which is the most educationally divided in Europe, we have a school where only two children a year go to university, and as I said, the Tatler recommended comprehensive, and that's forgetting the third of private schools in Oxford, which most of whom are schools you go to when you fail your entrance exam for Oxford High and for Magdalen and so on. So they're secondary moderns that you're paying to go to. I would merge the six state schools so that you can move the teachers between them, so that the Tatler recommended school doesn't have all the teachers aged 40 and the school at the bottom doesn't have teachers aged 21-22 leaving. And I would suggest to the senior management teams that they move towards designating one of the schools to be the science block, so you can have the best science facilities in the city, or you can pay to go privately. What do you want? This isn't a pipe dream. When I grew up in Oxford, I went to Cheyne School. Next door was Magdalen College Boys. And the boys who went to Magdalen College were 10 times more likely to go to university. Six of us from my school. Me, completely predictable, mum and dad were graduates. Six out of 300 from my school went to university. 10 times more for Magdalen Boys. It made complete sense to pay to send your son to that private school for that tenfold increase in life chances. Today, 250 children go to university from that comprehensive, an average comprehensive in Oxford, and they go to Leeds and Manchester. Almost all the boys from Magdalen go to university, and they go to places like Leeds and Manchester. So what exactly are you paying for when you pay for the private education in the first place? So tipping that in education isn't that hard to begin to do. The widening participation issue in our universities, we're nowhere. We're playing games with a kind of 6% increase in polar one whatever, and you just step back from it and you do what I do, which you just heard me being slightly rude, and you can just rip it apart as ridiculous. And UCAS have tried and tried and tried for years to produce those little graphs with the red and the yellow and the green. Right? Mark Corver was my PhD student in Bristol in the 1990s. He did that for years. You know, gradual kind of, you know, are these lines narrowing or not? We've still got the most elitist, arrogant university system in Europe. We've just got to accept that. And it's about time. David Lammy, in a way, has done us a favour. He might be very rude, but there comes a point when you actually have to stop congratulating yourself about my department, Geography in Oxford. We were in the Times three times on May 23rd. Three stories on my own department. We only have 82 undergraduates. We were there because we were with Classics and Music. We're the most elitist department in Oxford, the most elitist university in England, the most elitist country in the whole planet. What do I say to the new first year when I give a lecture to them in October? Welcome to the pinnacle of stupidity. What I think, obviously, they're only 18, the 82 of them. It's ridiculous. You know, it's not their fault they're there, but it's farcical. Things will happen. There comes a point where the level of embarrassment gets so high that it begins to change. There are heads of houses in Oxford trying to be progressive. It obsesses my university more than anything else. Mm-hmm. But my university on its own can't change it. And my university is like it is because the country became like it is. And my university was a nice university in the 1960s. There's the small faces, anybody remember? It's all too beautiful under Bridge of Sighs. What are you going to do there? We get high there. It was sung about Oxford. When the grammar school kids and the private school kids came together in the melting pot and they built in concrete because there were no philanthropists with money to build buildings. Oxford was a terribly elitist place in the 30s, it became a much nicer place in the 60s, and it's gone back to being elitist again. And this is acutely embarrassing for the leadership of my university. They want to change it, but they can't change it on their own. No single university could do it. UCL couldn't suddenly decide on its own to do it. But you're in a better position.
Can the higher education sector change it on its own, though? I guess is the level of my question. Or is it a much bigger societal change?
It could. It depends on the policy of UK. Now, obviously, it follows what the Vice Chancellors want. But the Vice Chancellors are changing their minds really quickly. Mine taking a 1% pay rise, Imperial taking a 1% pay rise. They begin to get the lesson about pay. Okay.
Right.
It takes a certain amount of newspaper headlines to get it through, but you kind of get there. Gender pay gap's been reported nationally, so we've had them reported for the first time. Universities UK will change its attitude as the Vice Chancellors change their attitudes. We're in a very strange position politically at the moment, in that a lot of these people at the top were educated in the 60s. So the heads of houses of Oxford and Cambridge colleges are more radical than the younger academics, who are 1980s loads of money people. But that change is possible. I mean, the big one, USS, you know, there's changes going to have to happen at the top of USS. Currently, if you're interested in the pensions, USS have a valuation that assumes that academics are going to live far, far, far longer than other people who are similar, without, as far as I can see, any evidence. And so currently we're playing a game of USS and saying, please can you show us the evidence? And they're going, oh, it's commercially confidential. Now, the question is, how embarrassing and public does that have to get before it cracks? And the same with the vice chancellors and the widening participation. That's where we're at. And it's worth just being ahead of the curve. It's worth, otherwise you're fighting a constant game of trying to defend being behind the things. But like I say, we're like 1913. You know, nobody knew what was happening around about then. For the 1920s and 30s, people didn't realise they were becoming more equal. They thought they were fighting a battle, which they were. And we're going to be in that same kind of situation, going to be spending the next 20 years having these kind of arguments about what is better and not better. But I suspect things will actually be getting better quietly all the time that we argue about it. And the hierarchy of universities will begin to diminish. Yeah. The idea of having a group that meet at the Russell Hotel, designed simply so the University of Sheffield can get into that group, you know, at some point, it might take comedy. I mean, it might take people actually saying how silly some of this is to actually begin to reduce it.
We have come to the end. I just hope on that optimistic note, and we don't have to go through two world wars in order to get the social changes that we wanted.
Brexit.
Maybe. Okay. Well, Danny, thank you very much indeed. That was really excellent. Thanks.